Hello and welcome to the first ever edition of Tech and Trees in English. This time I speak to Frederick Udenfeld. He's the VP of Product Vision at ClimateView. ClimateView is a climate action platform for cities. A major share of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide stem from the cities that we love so much. But whoever has ever lived in one can tell how much of a hustle and bustle is going on in these places. It is extremely hard to get these melting pots under control, and it is extremely hard to do so when it comes to reducing the emissions that cities cause. ClimateView helps to break down the complex urban systems into tangible actions. When cities set up a climate strategy, that can take several months, if not longer. With ClimateView, this process can actually be reduced down to a few days. This effort was rewarded with the placement among the 100 most innovative companies in the climate space worldwide in 2021. But that is not everything. Frederick himself is the embodiment of someone who managed to transition into career in climate change from a completely different background. He speaks Chinese fluently, which led him to become a diplomat working in China. Frederick describes his career as completely random and simply a series of coincidences, nothing else. While this podcast is great to get to know more about climate action for cities, Frederick's adventures in China are just as worth it. So have fun and enjoy listening.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Welcome, Frederick. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's start with like a few quick questions in the beginning. I would like to know, what is like a happy childhood memory of yours?
So I have quite a few memories, actually. I my first memory is like from age 8 or 9. And after that, not a huge deal of or amount of memories. So because I spend 99.9% of my time thinking forward. So that's maybe why my brain doesn't register too much of the past. But I did love fishing when I was a kid. So I have many happy memories from the countryside, fishing with my grandparents or my parents on a small boat. So yeah, that's something I enjoyed as a kid.
Sounds good. If you were now to complete the sentence, Frederick Udenfeld is?
Quick.
What is the most controversial idea that you are advocating?
So I'm not advocating this actively, but I do think that it's a bit strange the way people typically blame big oil for many of our problems. I think they're just doing their job, delivering the goods that people want. And I think if there's anyone who should be blamed, it's the people selling the equipment that uses the oil and the gas and the diesel, like the big car companies, the truck companies that have really not innovated in any meaningful way to get away from that fuel dependence.
Interesting. What KPI do you always have an eye on in your line of work?
For me personally, it's inbox zero. So if I lose track of my email and if I don't consistently reach inbox zero, then I know that something is wrong. That's my main KPI, I would say, on a personal level.
I love that. I follow the same pattern. What would you like listeners to remember you for after this podcast?
I just hope that people will find it helpful and that I provide value and just that I can manage to give practical, helpful advice. I just hope to be of use.
Sounds wonderful. Then let's get right into it, I would say. One of our main topics today is the climate transition in cities. I would like to know your thoughts about like what role do cities actually play in our fight against climate change?
So first of all, it's the city is a very helpful entity or a level to consider when you think about climate. Because if you think about it on the global level or the national level, it becomes quite abstract and complex. And if you think about it at the city level, then it just becomes much more concrete. Because in the city, there you need to build things, you need to change residents' behavior, and the city is the entity that is responsible for many of these things. So they do play a very important role in many of these shifts, the transitions, the changes that need to happen in order to reduce our emissions. And it's also a fact that more than 70% of global emissions come from cities. Cities are crucial and often under resourced, and they don't have the enough power and the resources to deal with many of these issues that they are facing.
So I was wondering, because you once stated that you are a fan of thought experiments, and in front of the background of what you just said, if we were to build the ideal climate-respecting city from scratch today, what would that look like? What are like the main building blocks?
So first of all, like, we could entirely do the whole climate transformation of a city without even saying the word climate, because many of these things, they just simply make sense. So who would not want to live in a city with great cycling facilities, electric buses, and fewer cars, and the few cars that do drive around are electric, and houses that are heated through electric heat pumps instead of gas or oil boilers. So this sounds like a dream city to me, and so that's how a city should look, and how it should be built. Of course, there is a great deal of inertia built into the city. It's hard to change these things, but it's really, the blueprint is quite clear. We need to shift the way we move around and the way we heat our buildings. Those are the two main things that need to happen. So that's what I think the ideal city looks like, and I think most residents would consider that a great city to live in as well.
So do I understand right when you say basically like a livable city is kind of equal to like a climate respecting city, or like that if you optimize for livability, then you automatically optimize for like climate neutrality or climate respecting?
So air pollution is a great problem in many cities. Noise, a big problem. Lack of insulation and costly heating, that's another big problem. Just congestion is a big problem. So these are problems that really reduce the quality of life in the city, and also can be directly harmful to cities, especially children. Like air pollution is very, very harmful to children. So those are like no-brainers. Those are things that need to be dealt with anyway. And now we have a great excuse to do them even faster.
I think it's amazing that you say that, because it's also like my personal thought usually that if we strive for a sustainable world, we actually strive for the most livable world we can potentially have. Like I'm usually confused by people who like oppose sustainability, because the end goal of it is kind of like just raising the quality of life of everyone, essentially. I'd be interested, what kind of problem cities should we have looked at like 10 years ago, in your opinion? You know, like what's the, maybe like the most urgent, or where did we really like not act when we should have?
So of course, some things are a matter of market forces, and like it would not have been a great point to, or maybe not a great idea to invest heavily in charging infrastructure 10 years ago, because the market just wasn't there. There weren't enough electric vehicles to supply the market. Other things are more or less independent of market forces. It's just about behavioral change. So cycling is one such thing. And if you look at the great cycling city today, like Amsterdam or Copenhagen, they were not always great cycling cities. So any city can become a cycling city. It's not rocket science. And there's no technological breakthrough, or there's nothing as such needed. So you can do it. Like Amsterdam did it 1970s or 80s onwards. Copenhagen started maybe 20 years ago. Now more cities are trying to catch up. So that could definitely have been done 10 years ago. Another thing that is slightly more complex, but equally or even more important, is heating of buildings. Many countries have gas and oil boilers as the primary mode of heating. So that's something that takes time to change. There's a great deal of inertia built into the system. You have landlords, you have permits, you have economic incentives, and all sorts of factors that go into that. And the earlier you start, the better your chances are to succeed. Like Sweden started that in the 1970s and you know, started the shift to heat pumps. And now we have very few boilers left, but UK cities are starting that journey now, and they have a hard journey ahead of them.
Do you feel confident that we will be able to overcome this inertia? Because you said, okay, like Sweden has started this transformation like 50 years ago almost, and like you're now about to finish it, for example. But like there's so many cities or countries who haven't started that journey yet. But like, do you think with learnings of other countries and like the technologies in play today, like we can like accelerate this process?
Yeah, I think they can do it. And the pressure is building up. And there is no excuse really to not do it. The only viable excuse is that gas is very cheap still in many countries. So heat pumps might not always be attractive economically in the short term, but almost always in the long term. So that, of course, there the government has a role to play to incentivize these technologies. But I think it's definitely doable, and the pressure is building, and it makes a great deal of sense economically for the household to do it in the long run.
Yeah. Like over the past couple of minutes, you have like named different action fields for cities. Could you just like quickly order them for me, like in like by priority, sort of like the top three or top four priorities for cities?
So mobility, personal mobility is almost always the biggest one or the second biggest one. So the way people move around in the city today, of course, to a high degree through fossil fuel cars. And if any city is supposed to reach zero carbon, then those have to go away. And considering that a new car on average lasts 14 years and there are still new fossil cars being sold, that will be a challenge. So, but luckily we have options. We can maintain the same level of mobility with other means of transport. We can shift to public transport. We can shift to electric vehicles. We can shift to cycling. And of course, we can shift to digital mobility, like as we have seen during the pandemic. And we knew this from before, that digital technologies have a huge potential in replacing trips, both long-distance trips and short-distance trips. And I think we're seeing a permanent shift to that. So personal mobility is a very important one. Then, of course, we have goods. But that's more of a market-driven thing, where I think as long as the technology is there and the market supplies electric vehicles, these goods companies will shift immediately, or at least as quickly as they possibly can, to electric modes, because it's just so much more cost efficient. So I think that sector will electrify by itself in many ways. Of course, it can be speeded up through incentives, but it's a really market governed in a good way. Heating is always also a big one for cities, or I mean, depends on which country, but in UK and Germany and US, certainly it's a big source of emissions, both heating and cooling.
Thank you. What is like a prime example of a city that is really like on track to like drive its climate transition?
So in one sense, there is no such city, because they are all at the very early outset of this journey. No one has done any such transformation going to zero carbon. It's unheard of. So that would be the short and dramatic answer. But then, of course, there are cities that have at least started meaningfully. And I think the best metric to look at is not necessarily like emissions or because differences are quite small. I think the best metric is how they organize themselves. So if they have set up in a flexible and collaborative way to go about this in terms of the city management internally, like if all the departments are on board working on this issue, and if they have involved the most important stakeholders in society, the big companies, civil society, residents, that tells me that they are on track to, or at least they have a greater chance of really having an impact. While if you only have like a lonesome climate team working in their own silo and having a hard time reaching across to other departments, like the housing department or the transport department, well, that's a worrying sign. then they will have a harder time, I think, having an impact. So I think that's a good indicator to look at when you look at cities, rather than these other numerical metrics, at least at this point.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you've just really nicely described like how complex the transition of a city towards climate neutrality is, because there are so many different stakeholders involved, and like you have to get them actively involved in collaboration to like speed up the process. I was wondering whether you maybe had like a practical example which would kind of illustrate how the difficulty of realizing like a climate initiative in a city.
Well, cycling is I think an interesting one, because there, on the one hand, it's quite straightforward. If you build good infrastructure, like really good, like a well-connected, cohesive cycling network, then cycling will almost always become the most competitive way of transporting or getting around the city. But of course, you will inevitably meet resistance, because there is a limited, finite space in the city. So if you build cycle lanes, that's often at the expense of the space that cars use. So that's a potential source of conflict. You need to invest money, of course, maybe at the expense of other initiatives. And there's always a certain degree of risk-taking. You don't know, you cannot know for sure that people will use these assets that you build. So you need political will and the some amount of willingness to take risks. And I think the cities that we have seen that succeed, they just do things and then they learn as they go. And what we try to do is to break down these things into small pieces and to create a common language for all these pieces. So when it comes to cycling, well, the network is one thing. Another thing is the maintenance of the network, including things like the winter maintenance. So you need a functioning network also in the winter. And there we know that some cities are better than others. So that's a good level at which you can learn from each other, winter maintenance. There is best practice for that, but that best practice does not spread naturally. So we can help make sure that spreads across cities and across countries.
You've just touched already on the next topic, and that is what ClimateView does, or what you help to do at ClimateView as well. And I think what I really love about your like the company you're at is like that you really aim to bring order to this like big, hard to manage complexity that cities kind of represent, right? Like you try to break it down in like manageable, actionable items. The thing is, like, I was wondering how do you develop such a product, right? Like how do you, because I imagine that it like takes a lot of co-development, like a lot of working together with cities to like draw up the right needs in this and like the right solutions, right? So I was wondering whether you could give me some insights into like the development process of the product at ClimateView and like the company that you have undergone over the past 2 years.
So everything we do is done in a very agile and iterative way. And so the founding story, I think, is quite telling in this regard. So our founder, he was an agile coach, helping big companies do complex transformations. And he figured that, well, if this method works so well for big corporations going through very messy and complex processes, wouldn't it work just as well for the climate? So he pretended that Sweden as a country was his customer. And what you do then as an agile coach or consultant is that you start out by building an overview, typically in the form of a big poster. So he created this huge poster, like 5 meters or 7 meters wide. And on this poster, like building out a tree structure, mapping out all the various sectors and all the initiatives and the big policies that were connected to these sectors, just to get an understanding of like, okay, what is actually being done? What has been decided within all these sectors, from transport to agriculture to industry and heating and energy? So then he had this overview, and he started to go around to different agencies and government authorities, and they were like, wow, we have never seen this overview. We did not know that all of these things are being done. And because it's very hard to get that overview. Like, even if they would commission someone to write a report to do that kind of overview, it would become out of date very quickly. probably by the time it's published already. So that then triggered them to ask him to, well, couldn't you do this digitally so that we can keep it up to date? And that's the way it went. So it was developed closely with them, primarily with the Swedish Climate Policy Council, and it evolved into a digital product. And so Sweden as a country was our launch customer. Then along the way, we realized that, well, to have the greatest possible impact, we want to work with cities because we think they are key to this challenge and to make the changes necessary. So then we started working with the cities, our first early adopters in Sweden and in the UK and Germany. Same there, we try to work very closely with them. So we never ask them, like, what do you need? Because that's very hard to say as a customer. It's our job to innovate and to propose solutions, but then we show them to the customers at a very early stage. Like, so we do a lot of prototyping, showing like at the very, very early, you know, ugly mock-ups. We show them and sometimes we workshop with them just to understand, like, what do you actually need? Where can we actually make a difference in your work life when you manage this transformation? So that's how we work in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah. Would you mind maybe like guiding me through like a user journey, kind of, if I were a user of the Climate View product? You know what I mean? Like how would you actually manage to make like a systems level action tangible within your product?
So what we do is we take the climate goal of the city. So let's say that it's to reach zero emissions 2035. And then our system, our software, and the model within the software breaks down this goal into targets. We call them transition targets. So these are what these are shifts. So we shift from fossil fuel cars to public transport, to cycling, to EVs. And every such shift needs a target. And we need to make sure that these targets add up to the greater goal, because otherwise we will never reach the goal. And so for every one of these shifts, we have a target for 2040, the same end year. And then we can walk backwards from there and see, okay, what does this mean year by year? So for example, that could mean that, well, by 2022, you need to shift these many cyclists from cars or you need to shift these many motorists from cars to cycling. And then they need to work toward that goal and to take action. So this is done through various steps in the software, and they can do this alone. So we spend some time with them when they get started, but we try to automate as much as possible of these steps and spend less and less time with the customer and to make it as intuitive and self-manageable as possible.
You've said now like that you spend a lot of time very closely with cities, right? With those city bodies. I'm wondering a little bit, like, you know, in like business, you have this classic division between like B2C and B2B, right? Like you are a B2G, so a business to government business, right? Like what makes like working with governmental actors unique? You know what I mean? What are maybe the biggest pain points also in there?
I think it's quite similar to B2B. It's about delivering value. It's about finding pain points, as you said. So that's similar to any B2B software. Of course, the sales cycle is different with government. In some ways, but not in all ways. When it comes to pain points, there are a few major ones that we help solve. One is before we were around and before we worked with cities, what they would do when they set out on such a goal, they might hire a consultant to help them understand what this means in practice and maybe set some targets or propose actions. But that consultant might not always share the underlying assumptions, the calculations. So it might be some sort of black box that it comes out of. And in the end, you get this PowerPoint report or a PDF that is delivered to you that you might not feel entirely full ownership of. So it's hard to kind of translate that into action directly. And of course, that also costs money to hire people and so forth. So that's one thing that they can avoid through working with us. Another is just managing all these different pieces. And it's just, I think, for many of our customers, it's typically quite a painful process just reaching out to all sorts of colleagues across all departments and making sure that they do things that are not their core mission. Like if you're the transport department, climate might not be your core priority. So you have to convince them to do more, and you have to keep track of what they do and encourage them to do more, and also just understand what they do. Just so that it's not always a collaborative atmosphere by default. So we can help them, we can help empower them and give them a platform in which they can involve these colleagues in a meaningful way to create that team spirit, which we think is necessary to make things happen in the city. So that's another pain point, just that internal collaboration part. Another big pain point is reporting. So many cities spend a lot of time in Excel preparing reports to third parties like CDP. So they have to report their emissions and all sorts of things to these third parties, or sometimes EU, different EU institutions. And that's not fun for them. And it takes time. And if you're a small city, or if you only have like one or two people working with climate, well, then it's kind of unfortunate that you have to spend that, this overhead time not doing other things. But this we can automate. And we can already do that to a degree, but we will in the future even more. So just by the click of a button, they can do things that would take weeks before in Excel. And of course, lots of anxiety and pain.
How dare you say that Excel is not fun? I cannot relate to that. Like you've been acting as the VP of community growth at Climate Youth for the major part of the last 2 years there. So you've been kind of at the forefront of like working with cities and like kind of getting your product to them. I was wondering, like, what would a typical day like look for you at in this process? You know what I mean? Like, what does a good day look for you?
So I started as working with the sales, which community growth means. That was my first job at Climate View. I was the first actually international salesperson. I was the first one to initiate our international expansion when I joined. So we were only 10 people at the time when I joined, and now we're more than 40. And so it was a lot of outreach, of course, trying to reach cities and to initiate conversations. And a great day would be when people got back to me and said, yeah, we're interested and we want to talk. An even better day would be a day with a meeting, because we found very quickly that almost everyone, at least those who read their emails, they were typically interested in us because we were something new, something exciting. So almost all cities wanted to talk. And when we spoke, we were always met by enthusiasm. And so these were very exciting meetings. And just, you know, being able to share something new, something they seemed to genuinely appreciate, that was a lot of fun. And we also learned a great deal about how they work and also saw things and opportunities that we could develop. So just meeting cities was a lot of fun for me in those first years.
I have to ask a little bit, like, what's like, what was email your main like outreach channel? Like what kind of channel worked best for you to actually like get through to the people?
Yeah, email, I would say email. And that's, I think, the way government typically works also, like through email. But my colleague who worked with German cities, I think he was spent quite a lot of time on the phone. So that was another way of doing it there. I think email worked less well there in Germany. And I was working mainly with the UK and Swedish cities. They prefer email, I think.
Did you have to like try out a lot of like different subjects and so on and so forth? Or was it like rather easy to get answers? Or did you have like any kind of hack to get people's attention?
I wouldn't say I was very good at that. I did try many things. I'm not sure still which one was the best. I think sales is an interesting art form. I had never done it before, so there was a great deal of catching up for me and learning. But it's actually quite fun, and it's just about trying to communicate value and understand pain points and problems that you can help solve. And sometimes you find out, well, we don't have that problem that you thought we had, or we're not interested in that, and that's fine. But other times you do find that match, and that's great when you do that. So it's just a, like information arbitrage in a way, or just it was surprisingly fun. But yeah, the kind of the writing email part and the headlines, that was of course slightly less fun. And I still don't know like any magic tricks.
I see it. And now you previously told me to our conversation that you have like started your third career now, right? Like now you're the VP of Product Vision at Climate View. How has that like been treating you?
So I even when I was doing sales, I was already quite involved in product development because I was talking to cities all the time and I was also part of onboarding them, getting to know them very well and the way they work, and also, of course, saw, you know, issues with our product, because we were still in a very early stage with the product. It was quite a basic product still, and so there were plenty of room for development. And I often suggested things and tried to get involved in the product development. And eventually I was just pulled into the product department. So now I'm part of that, which I love. And I still get to meet cities, but now more to, you know, existing cities, existing customers, to prototype things and to, yeah. So, which I love. So yeah, it's my third career is the product is in product, which I love, and I think that this might go on for a long while.
From that point of view, then, can you tell me a little bit about like where the future lies for Climate View and your product?
So we're now in a fortunate position of just having done our Series A. So we just raised more than 10 million euros in capital. So now we can hire a lot of people, so we can grow from currently having 40 people to maybe hopefully twice that at some point. So this will give us a lot of muscle in terms of product development, but also just feet on the ground. And there is a lot still to be done with the product, and especially when it comes to the economic aspects of the climate transition. So this is a big area of development for us in the future, really trying to highlight and to model the various benefits of the climate transition. Because if you look at these different shifts, the shift to cycling, the shift to public transport, and the shift to heat pumps, they make a lot of sense, as I said before. And you can almost always attach a number to that. Like, what's the value of the children of our city breathing clean air? You can place a number on that. And if you do that, then you get a positive return on investment. And that you can use to build a business case for these transitions. So that's one of the big areas for us going forward. Another is just to make it even easier for cities to take action and just to find and improve that common language and the taxonomy for actions. Now cities have these action plans, they're all taking action on their own, but there is a limited opportunity for them to learn from each other, because these things are very local in nature and the wheel is reinvented all the time everywhere. And there we believe we can play a much bigger role than we do today, and that's another area that we're working a lot on, and something that I lead personally.
Yeah, I love it. Helping cities to like communicate the value they create to the outside even better, and like also internally, really good. Here I would like to make a little switch and kind of trace back your steps and like see how you actually ended up in the startup world, because you have had life before joining Climate View. And let's start with like Chinese studies, actually. Like, can you tell me a bit about like how that came about?
It was totally random. I never been to China, never been to Asia. I was 18 and I was kind of interested in learning Japanese, but that university class was full. So then I just randomly saw this ad on the internet for like this web-based university course in Chinese. So at this Swedish university, and I signed up and I kind of forgot about it. And then like 2 months later, I was admitted and I started, and then it was quite fun, but not much more than that. But then I got the chance to go there for a summer course. So I spent the summer of 2007, I think, in Beijing, and I loved it. But the biggest thing for me was that I realized that Chinese wasn't as hard as I thought, and I was actually quite well suited for some strange reason to learn Chinese. So I just learned it very quickly. I had never been a great language learner before. I was very bad at learning German in school, and maybe I wasn't motivated. I don't know, but like Chinese, I just learned it very quickly, and then that kind of went onwards from there. So I just kept studying Chinese all the way alongside other topics that I studied, including economics and political science. So it was very random.
So does that mean that you accidentally ended up in like Chinese studies, and so you accidentally became a diplomat afterwards, or how did that happen?
Yes, also quite accidentally. Yes, I mean, I was studying political science and economics, and of course, working for the foreign ministry was something that many people there, like my classmates, something that most people wanted to. There aren't so many employers in that space, like in Sweden. Of course, there are other government authorities, but most people typically want to end up at the ministry. So I figured, well, maybe I should work there as well. They were seeking Chinese speakers at the time, and probably still do. So it was easier for me to get in, and also did an internship and a few other. I spent a few years working in China before I entered the ministry, and so it was quite easy for me to get in there. But also, yeah, fairly random.
How much time did you actually spend as a diplomat then?
6 years, I think, depending on how you count.
Yeah, and you spent all those 6 years like basically traveling between Sweden and China all the time, or like how did that work?
I spent 3 years as a diplomat, as like a proper diplomat in China, but 6 years if you count other roles, and then
okay.
I spent 2 years in Sweden afterwards, traveling a lot to China and to Asia.
Do you have like a most memorable moment from your diplomat career?
Well, China is a crazy place. It's just so intense, and things move at a very fast pace. It's like a huge startup, the whole country. So every day brought crazy stuff. The craziest maybe was for one period, I was following the steel industry very closely, like trying to help Swedish companies, Swedish suppliers get into the steel business in China, or delivering, you know, equipment and solutions to Chinese steel companies. And so I got to know a few Chinese steel companies very well. And I was invited to their annual banquet, the annual meeting of the Chinese steel industry. So it was this massive meeting with, I think, 1,000 people, like Chinese steel executives. And I was the only foreigner in the room. I still have no idea like why I was invited, and I don't think it would have happened today. It was just so weird, and at that time the Chinese steel industry was under huge pressure, like price pressure, and a lot of companies were going bankrupt, and they just were. I remember one like very high level official from Beijing who said, "The winter is coming." That was like his opening sentence, like the Game of Thrones reference, when he kind of set the tone for the conference. It was pretty cool. And then in the evening, there was this banquet, and Chinese steel people, they love to drink, and they love to drink Chinese like rice liquor, like very, very strong rice liquor. It was just like this crazy drinking dinner. And of course, they wanted to drink with me. So yeah, that was wild.
I love the picture, like a Swede in the middle of a lot of like Chinese steel executives. Amazing. I'm kind of wondering, like I imagine you're in that situation right now, like you have to kind of like know your way around conversations and kind of networking, right? Like has that also like I imagine you to be kind of like a master of the skill by now, right? Like I guess like the Chinese school has kind of like hardened you in that way. Has this like skill of like conversation or networking also helped you with your transition into climate action?
Well, I would say I was pretty poor at these things compared to my Chinese colleagues. So most Chinese people are like from a very young age, very, very good at networking and just have great social skills because they often have great big, big families, and you have to navigate all sorts of, you know, ties and, you know, just your extended network of family and friends in your city. And these networks are much bigger than the typical European family. And you just are much closer to your relatives than you would be in Europe, I think. So people are just better at that from a young age. And they also are often good at maintaining networks. So I had a call, like my Chinese colleague, the one that worked the closest with me, he just had this massive network and he was the one kind of helping me keep track of all these things. And so like, I didn't have to take care of that. And so he was constantly on his phone on WeChat, which is like the Chinese version of WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger, constantly messaging with people and just fixing stuff and arranging stuff and just keeping in contact with people. So I didn't have to do that. I just had to show up and just smile and just speak Chinese and just go with the flow. And that's typically the best way to go about things in China. Just go with the flow and just like, well, because you end up in weird situations all the time. So that what it did teach me, I guess, was a big amount of flexibility and which you do need in a startup environment.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I would like to know a bit more about like the day when you realized you were going to leave like your diplomatic career and like go into the startup world or like make the switch to like fighting climate change. Like how did that come about?
So I had for a long time, or at least a couple of years, been thinking a lot about the climate, and I could not see how I could make a meaningful difference at the ministry. The closest thing you can come to is climate aid, which is basically funding the World Bank and other big institutions in their climate work. But that's far from the action. So I wasn't very interested in that. I considered going into other government agencies or ministries, like the energy ministry. But I also didn't seem to be very attractive to me. So I just kind of gave up and I didn't think much about it. And then one day, very randomly, we had a state visit from South Korea that I was part of managing. So I was responsible for the business delegation. So the Korean president was in Sweden and going around to different places together with the Swedish king. And one of those places was this startup incubator with impact startup called Norsken or Norsken. And we had this pitch event and I was the moderator and we invited a couple of different startups to pitch in front of the audience, including the president and the king, but also Korean investors. And one of those companies were ClimateView. I didn't notice them really because I was too busy thinking about what to say next up on the stage and how to address the king properly. But they seemed to have noticed me. So one of the co-founders came up to me afterwards and I asked if I wanted to talk. And I said, well, yeah, sure. And kind of, I think 2 days later we met and I quickly decided to join. And basically within a few days, I had quit my job at the ministry.
So you were just like recruited away in a matter of days. Sounds like I don't know, like a difficult decision to make. Like, what were like inner questions that you had at the time to, or that you like asked yourself?
It was a quite easy decision. It just seemed like a great match for me. And I'm the kind of person that I have a different definition of risk than most people. Like I didn't see any downside in that really. I could always, go back to the ministry if I wanted to, probably, or even, and like, there's just, there wasn't a great deal of risk involved, only upside. So in that sense, it was not a hard decision. What I, of course, did think about was I had never worked for a company before, and I tried to understand, of course, how big are the chances that they might succeed, and like how far have they come and like are they telling me the truth and like those kind of things. But I was hooked anyway, so it didn't matter too much. But like in hindsight, of course, I later realized that we had not come very far and I think they didn't realize that themselves either. And you never do when you're in the moment, but we were at a super early stage. We barely had a product when I joined.
I was just going to ask, like you said, when you joined, you were 10 people, right? Like, so there was not much to like look at or evaluate, right?
Exactly. So like I kind of didn't care too much about the product. What got me hooked was the vision and the the forward-leaning kind of momentum rather than where they were exactly then. And that still goes for today. Like, the most exciting things lie in the future, not where we are today. That was the most important thing to me.
Yeah. And you've said that twice now, that you're like a person who looks to the future, right? You look forward. Was there anything, though, that you were like sad to leave behind in diplomacy?
No, not too much. I mean, only colleagues. So the ministry is fun because a lot of smarts and fun people to work with. It's a great environment in that sense. I got a lot of friends there and you learn many things and it's obviously a very international environment. So in that sense, I miss it sometimes, but it's also a very harsh place to work for. It's as you might imagine, it's government. So,
what were you looking forward to then? Like, apart from the vision, apart from really standing behind this vision of climate transition for cities.
So it's just the daily grind of taking that vision and turning it into a product expression on a daily basis. And what I have realized over time, and this took some time for me to realize it, is how is product actually built? And now I'm talking software specifically. Hardware is, of course, different. But you cannot build software in big chunks. If you build a car, of course, then you might spend a couple of years designing and prototyping, etc. But then eventually it's just a car. It's a piece of hardware. But software doesn't appear that way. It might in some exceptions, but those are rare exceptions. Software evolves in a great number of iterations. If you look at the Wayback Machine, that place where you can look at old websites, and you look at early days Google or Airbnb, and they looked horrible at that time, and they just they just put it out there, and they, well, partly because they had to, because and also because they didn't know better. And then you need to start somewhere, and then you need to start to learn and iterate, and that's how great products are built. So you constantly need to learn and collect data and just information and of course get to know your customers and just iterate. And that's what's so fun, and tying that to the vision, so that you have a vision, of course, that you're striving for, but that vision also has to materialize every day when you iterate on the product.
Yeah. I'm wondering though a little bit, everything you've just said, that's what you know today, right? I'm wondering, how much of that did you actually know when you joined? And how did your diplomatic skills or diplomat skills actually transfer into the startup world?
I think my colleagues would describe me as pretty undiplomatic. In some ways, I can be, I usually speak my mind, in a respectful way, but I think that's also the only way to survive as a startup. In a big organization, a big company or a government institute, then you can, for instance, let's say that I was in a big meeting at the ministry and someone brought up this idea, and I might think, or I might know that, well, this is obviously not going to work. This is a terrible idea. But there's no reward really for saying that. It's just a risk, basically. There's no upside. That would just create bad will and put me in a bad spot, and also the other person. So if anything, I might bring that person to the side and whisper something to that, but still it's, and of course, and there's never any single idea that is mission critical to the whole organization. So you just, and that of course creates a general atmosphere of niceness and you can, just a cozy atmosphere, because there's never any existential threat. But in a startup, there's always an existential threat. So if there is a problem, you need to get to that problem immediately, and you need to be very honest with each other. And that can create friction, but it also can be very exciting, because you get very close to your colleagues. So I'm kind of undiplomatic, I think. But maybe when I, of course, externally and when I talk to customers, and I think I have a way to speak to government representatives and city representatives that maybe some of my colleagues are not familiar with. So I can speak the language of government, I guess. So that's helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm wondering though, like, what did the split between like winging your work as well as like actually knowing what you are doing look like? What did that look like in like the first couple months that you were there?
Oh, I was totally winging it. Like, absolutely. So I didn't know anything, and we knew very little in general. So we were just, of course, we had like a vision and so forth, and but like we had to wing it. Like my first week, we went to Copenhagen, and I managed to get a few meetings there with the government and with cities, and we just quickly pulled together some sort of pitch, and like we totally wing it, it's kind of embarrassing to even think about like how we must have seemed in those meetings, but still we just had to try stuff and to learn, because otherwise we would have never learned those things that we later on could incorporate in the product, and it became very valuable to us. So you always have to wing things, and I think that's my big learning from all over my career, is that like people are winging it everywhere. Like even in, I think if you look in the White House, like people are winging it everywhere, and there's nothing mythical or magical about any workplace. As soon as you get inside, it's like everywhere else.
I love that. I can resonate very much with like winging stuff, because it's also like what I tend to do usually. But at the same side, it's also important to like keep educating yourself, right? And like read about what you're actually doing, especially like with a topic like climate change, where you can easily go down the wrong lane if you like are not really like proficient in, you know, the topic kind of, right? And so I've seen that you frequently share some like long form articles or books that you like really like touched you, right? From that point of view. So on topics such as like rare earths or the workings of the energy system. And so I was wondering, like, how do you read up and educate yourself about climate change and like adjacent topics?
I spend a lot of time and energy on learning in general. I think it's a big misconception in society that you learn in school and then you work and can stop learning. I think when you work, that's when you need to, if anything, accelerate the pace of learning. So I spend every evening really purposefully trying to learn things. I take university courses right now in math and physics, and I also read a little bit all the time. I mean, I have small children, so I can't like sit down and read for hours, but like I always read stuff on the Kindle app on my phone, and just constantly try to pick up new knowledge, and not just knowledge itself, but like building the architecture to absorb knowledge. Like that's why I try to learn better math, because that's like it's a way of learning that way I can access more knowledge. And I'm now 34, and like I've only just started learning. Like I have 40, 50, 60 years left of learning, and I've noticed the power of doing small things every day. If you do something every day, it adds up to a lot. There's no point in doing like one big thing occasionally. It's much better to do something small every day.
Yeah. Could you expand on what you mean by like an architecture of learning?
Yeah, so let's say like obviously we've all been in different rabbit holes on Wikipedia, right? Let's say that I end up in the Wikipedia page for DNA and genomics. You know, of course it might be fun. I spend a few minutes there and go on to some other articles, but it would be hard for me to absorb that knowledge in any meaningful way, because I can't connect the dots. I don't have the foundation to connect those pieces of knowledge to something else, because I don't know enough biology and genomics. But if I would have that foundation in my mind, then I can integrate that knowledge much more quickly, because I have the building blocks. And I think that's the way the brain works. It's like an intricate web of connections, you know, neural connections. So what I mean by the architecture is just having the in one way of saying it would be having the language. Like math is a language through which you can access knowledge in physics or in computer science. Another way would be just it's a method of learning, I guess, and it also gives you a lot of patience to learn. So if you become accustomed to sitting 2-3 hours with a math problem, then really, there's nothing that seems boring after that. So you can do any work problem easily after that. So just because it's so easy to trick yourself into thinking that you learn things, like browsing Wikipedia or reading some book and like, oh, that was interesting. Now I feel smarter, but I really didn't learn anything, or just quickly goes away in the mind. So learning for real is quite hard. You need the foundation, you need the architecture, but you also, I think, need to teach others about it. That's the only way to truly learn, I think, to explain to others and help others. And that I haven't quite reached to yet.
But is that though the moment, like when you're able to teach somebody else about a certain topic, when you know, okay, I've learned this topic, like I've learned about this truly?
Yeah, at least to some degree. Of course, you never learn fully, and I think usually what happens is that you just become aware of your own ignorance, and like at least you know what you don't know to some degree. that tells me that you've come some way. If you think you know a lot, then you probably don't know a lot. If you know that you don't know a lot, then you probably know more than you think.
Yeah, makes sense. Fredrik, thank you so much. Like we're coming to the end of our time, so I would just like quickly like to wrap it up with like five short questions. The first one is like, what question can people ask themselves to start their own journey into sustainability?
I think for me, scale is a important and underestimated topic. There is a great deal of attention in media and elsewhere about fancy technologies that might never be able to reach scale, and that's the only way to really have an impact, to reach scale. And I think it might sound like unexciting, for instance, you can have a huge impact if you become like a solar PV salesperson, or like a heat pump, you know, work for a heat pump company. Those technologies are ready to deploy at scale. While some other like more fancy technology, well, it might be possible to scale, but then you need to figure out, I think you can often through some bit of research find out, well, is this scalable or not? Like how big can this actually become? And that's, I think, an important lens to put on this if you truly want to have an impact. And then, of course, you need to pick up the knowledge. Like in my case, if I would go back 15 years, I would probably I would study engineering or physics instead of social science in my case. But that, of course, doesn't go for everyone. But it's helpful, of course, to understand those fundamentals, I think, when you work with sustainability.
Yeah. Touching on that, like among younger people, eco-anxiety is kind of on the rise. And like, so what kind of advice would you give young students for their way?
That one individual can have a surprising degree of impact on the world. It's hard, but anyone can have a huge impact, and you need to work hard to have that impact. And yeah, building things is hard. So find people who build and create solutions and learn from them. And then one day, maybe you can be the person to build yourself.
What gives you hope that we're looking at a bright future?
I think the power of innovation, clearly. We're just at the very, very outset or beginning of the age of technology. We've just been going for a few decades, really, or maybe a few hundred years, if you're generous. If we go 1,000 years in the future and look back to now, it will come across as kind of a Stone Age situation. I think we're just at the beginning of infinity in a way. There's an infinite amount of things that will happen, and as long as we maintain the acceptance and of critical thinking and to make sure that we encourage innovation.
Yeah. What do you want people to take away from this talk?
That people just learn. Always be learning things. I hope that more people should learn new things and try new things. Don't be afraid and reassess your way of seeing risk. What you might consider risky is probably not risky, and vice versa. And if you're in a career or some path that you are not happy with, it's a very low risk to switch paths, especially if you're like if you're 20, 30, 40 years old, there's a long way to go. And you can entirely switch career totally. And there's no risk in that. And never, ever consider sunk costs an important factor. Sunk costs are just like gifts from your past you that you can entirely disregard. And you can totally try out new things with very little risk.
And lastly, how can people today support the solution you are working on?
I think we will be recruiting quite a lot. So keep a watch on our website, climateview.global. And that's one way. We need great people to work for us. And just follow us on LinkedIn or just stay engaged. And and spread the word. And if you're not interested in working for us yourself, tell others.
Fredrik, thank you so much for being here today. Like, it was a really big pleasure and like took out a lot. So thank you so much for taking the
time.
You.